Hello and welcome to another episode of the Dan Assor Show, supported by show community patrons TF Connect, Tarsus Group, 19 Group, SISO and Smart Digital. This week I spoke with Alison Jackson, Group Managing Director of 19 Group, a rapidly expanding, dynamic and ambitious events business, delivering major scale trade exhibitions within the security, fire, emergency services, health and safety, facilities management and maintenance engineering sectors. Please check out all of my content on danassor.com and be notified first about new episodes by subscribing to my YouTube channel and by following me on Apple Podcasts and Spotify platforms.
Hello and welcome, Alison. How are you today?
Good, thank you. Good morning. Glad it's Friday.
Indeed. And we're going to talk about the room that you're in a minute because... I know you're having some renovations done at 19, but we'll go into the reasons why in a second. But Alison, to start off with, we've got quite a few topics to get through. Thank you for joining the show today. For those that aren't aware, I'm sure they're few and far between. It'd be great if you can just sort of introduce yourself, your role at 19, and also just give a brief overview of the group, please.
Great. So I'm Alison Jackson. Thanks, Dan. And I'm Group MD of 19. I've been doing B2B trade shows for over 30 years, and so I've worked for quite a lot of the larger companies, both when they were PLCs and then private companies, and also small businesses and a conference business IR, and I've also sort of worked for myself, and I keep telling myself I'm going to get a proper job. I started this after doing a languages degree. I did it to pay off my university overdraft, and I guess I must love it because I have tried to leave several times and keep coming back like a boomerang. And 4 years ago, I'm trying to think what year, 2018, 4 years ago, around this time of year, actually, I met Peter Jones, and I'd heard of him, but I'd never met him. And I met him because I was working for a business that wanted to buy his security show, and it wasn't for sale. And I met with him and Phil Saw, and they said, oh, we're looking to get a private equity backer. Are you interested? And to be honest with you, Dan, I've always really wanted to do my own business, but I've never been brave enough to do it on my own. And so before I knew it, I was in a day's worth of assessments in a private equity assessment centre and going through interviews. And to be honest with you, it was a punt. And... Peter and I we've got complementary skills. We've got good backers, Phoenix, and the pandemic has been kind to us. Actually, we've one of the few that have benefited.
Yeah, which we're going to talk about. Absolutely. Yeah. I just want to take you back. Thank you for that brief intro. I want to take you back to when you left the University of England, having done a modern languages degree, which you've put it out there, so I'm allowed to say it was in 1989 on LinkedIn. It says that anyway. what were you thinking at the time in terms of, because I've had lots of people on this show, as you know, and lots of people have told me how they've got into the wonderful, sometimes weird world of events and specifically trade show and exhibitions. What were you thinking? What were you going to, did you have an idea of what you were going to do?
No clue at all. No clue at all. I don't think my mum will be watching this, but went to university to please my mum. I didn't really want to go, I have to say. I was sort
we
of
all did that.
The first person in our family to get a degree. And then I had to have a year off in Spain and France. And rather than go to university, I had a job. And the job in Spain was in a teacher training college. And so I knew I didn't want to be a teacher. And then the job in France was for an exhibition company, but not a B2B. It was like a cultural exhibition where you were bringing bits of art over from the UK. And I was basically making the tea and came back, didn't have a job, didn't really know what to do. I had a boyfriend in London and thought, I'll go to London and saw a job in The Guardian for an exhibition company, Montgomery's. Of course, and I made the connection. I thought I've worked for an exhibition company, but very different. And started off as a graduate trainee for Montgomery's.
So that's how you got in it, which is really interesting. So you've been in the industry for a number of years. I'm going to touch upon something you just brought to life there. You said you hadn't been brave enough, your words, to set up your own thing. Why do you think that is? Or is it because the opportunities that you had were exciting enough? You know, just I'm interested to explore that a bit further.
I was always okay at doing my own freelancing, even though I found that a bit boring because you have to, you know, all the kind of admin backup when you're working for yourself. I turned down a fabulous opportunity to set up and work with David Wood on what became EcoBuild. And at the time I wanted to have a baby, so turn that down. And then just really, I spoke to people at Andy Center when he was alive. I got on very well with him, and he would say, you'll be great at running your own business. And just, I just didn't ever have the balls or the confidence to do it on my own.
It's an interesting one, because I guess I share a similar experience. I did a few things by myself, but and then you sort of get led into speaking to people and then get jobs. And also life takes over, right?
Yeah.
The old adage is you can try these things possibly when you're a bit younger, when you've got sort of fewer responsibilities. But obviously you've had a job that you enjoy and had a great career. Your role as managing director at the moment of 19 Group, MD, similar to all the other titles that people have at organizations, can mean different things to different people, depending on the organization. Just bring to life your role. What does managing director mean?
Well, it's changed. Look, the first week when I joined Peter's business, it was in the cupboard, just around the corner.
Yeah.
You know, the job I did then was very different. It was we were literally, you know, digging the business out of the ground with spades, you know, literally doing every single budget, talking to customers. You would not probably describe that as a managing director role.
This is not what I signed up for.
yeah. Well, actually, I did. I mean, I'm quite open. I think on the first day, I did think, what on earth have I done? And literally, I just thought, well, I've got to get on with it make it work. But now it's much more established, and we've got sort of, I always call them clusters in our business. So we've got, you know, we've almost got like MDs within each bit of the business. So it very much now is a group MD. So for safety and security, for retail, for the other security event, for ESS, for manufacturing, we've got leaders who are really competent. Of course, now we've got Michael Costain doing Lyrical. You know, those people in the next level below me are really competent. They're a great group of people. So I'm not doing, you know, I'm not down in the weeds, which is great because it frees us up to look at acquisitions, look at how we might grow the business, get out of the UK. I mean, we like going to the NEC, but it'd be nice to start going abroad, etc. And doing sort of less of the, I mean, I'm very much over the trading, the day-to-day. I could probably tell you the numbers on every single event we've got.
Yeah.
We've got great people now leading those teams, the next level down. And they're all people, they're many people that I've stolen, I've worked with before.
Okay. Thank you. And we're going to talk about some of the recent events and shows. You know, I read a lot on socials, and obviously it's social, so people tend to put the best stuff out there that, you know, the return to live over the last year or even this quarter, record numbers at trade shows, quality of visitors are up. Is that your experience at the shows that 19 have put on? What's the market telling you over the last sort of six months to a year? And also more recently, you've had obviously some shows.
Well, look, I kind of almost feel embarrassed saying this, but I think we're really lucky in that we're in very resilient markets. So if you think about all the markets we're in, traded through the pandemic. So whether it's safety, security, emergency services, manufacturing, they weren't working from home doing Zoom calls. They were in doing the jobs. Sure. And so I think we're kind of lucky from that perspective. We were pretty much fully operational during the pandemic. We went into the pandemic with about 30 people. We've now got 100. And so we were selling stands. We were still, you know, we didn't pivot to digital. We were refreshing our data. And, you know, whether it's just the momentum behind us, the markets, you know, it's not rocket science what we do, but our business has grown 70% this year without the acquisitions. And every show has exceeded. I think our lowest audience growth is about 10%.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's from an awful lot of hard work that went on pretty much from the day we went into lockdown.
Yeah.
Because we always believed that shows would come back.
And when you say hard work, a lot of work that went into it sort of during the period where you weren't running shows, can you just give us a flavour of what that meant? What sort of things did you do?
All the stuff, the day-to-day, the things that you probably, when you're running trade shows, you don't do. So we refreshed most of our data, put in a new CRM. Yeah. We were still connecting exhibitors with visitors, so we could kind of keep them sort of, though they would roll over and they were making connections. Yeah. We launched two shows, retail and M&E Week, during a pandemic. So we weren't sort of sitting there going, you know what, I wonder what this is going to be like. Because we fundamentally believe, I know Peter's evangelical about it, that face-to-face is the best way for a trade show to operate. So, you know, we didn't get distracted by virtual exhibitions or hybrid. We did some webinars. We won an award for one of them. But we were completely focused on, when shows reopen, we are going to come out, we're going to accelerate out of the corner fast with the best data and the best people we can get. And, you know, that investment has been returned. But it was a risky, I mean, it could have gone horribly wrong, Dan. It's great. Yeah. It's great now to say, oh, we had a plan. We'd literally, you know, we sat in the boardroom and I think probably Peter got me to say it. And I said, we're not firing anyone. And also during the pandemic, we had quite a lot, you know, we still met people, all the acquisition targets. We carried on all those dialogues, you know. It was a bit of, what can we do now to sort of invest in the business for when you know, we get back to running face-to-face events. And I get really irritated when, you know, if I read a press release about shows are back, they've been back for every year, you know. That's kind of old news now, move on. But
no, it is. And the reason for the question is because, having seen from the outside how 19 have developed, you know, you mentioned a figure of, and it sort of said it as a throwaway comment, but it is amazing that you've gone from 30 staff to 100 during this period, right? Because an outsider looking in could think, well, they're a trade show company. Clearly, they're going to have a period of contraction. They're not going to invest so heavily during this period. I'm talking about the last 18 months. And also, because you're partly private equity owned, and you mentioned Phoenix before, and some of the press that private equity firms get, not then necessarily, I'm just generally, you think, well, actually, they're private equity owned. The private equity, you get all about the bottom line, they're going to want to cut, you know. So,
yeah,
really interesting that Phoenix haven't been like that. It'd be interesting to understand your sort of relationship with them and how those conversations went, you know, in terms of.
Well, they weren't always the easiest conversations. Yeah. Because, you know, if you're like Phoenix, you've got a portfolio of investments.
Sure.
And you've got some in the manufacturing space that are working through, or the medical space are working through the pandemic. They're doing really well. And then all of a sudden you've got, I think it was ourselves and a holiday company, holiday letting company. We were right down the bottom of their table. You know, we were the biggest red flag ever. And so we did have some honest conversations. I mean, you know, they could have closed the business. We'd only traded for a year and a bit. We'd had a good year. And, you know, Phoenix could have probably, someone would have picked up the business and for not very much money, and Phoenix could have got their money back and moved on. And I think, you know, having Phil as chairman helps, because he was able to put it into context to say, you know, I always remember him ringing me up and saying, do you not know anything about pandemics? They last 12 to 18 months, you know, and having him say, look, you know, trade shows survive wars, you know, they've survived, you know, flu pandemics, you know, you're just going to have to wait. I know it's really frustrating, but it was a leap of confidence. I mean, it could have gone the other way. We had no way, by the way, of knowing that when we came out, we would grow in the way we have. So it was a punt, and it was very much, don't go and pretend you're good at digital, because you're not. We've invested in a trade show business. And, you know, but it could have gone the other way. I mean, literally, I think in April, there was a day in April around Easter when everyone else was probably going out for their week, you know, their daily walk, and it was beautiful weather, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, and this lockdown was still quite new, and it was quite, you know, it's not so bad, you know, we're at home and we're in the garden. And there was a day when I thought, you know, I kind of said to my husband, I think we'll get closed down, because why would you? And in fact, we sat and we discussed it, and of course we had to have an injection of cash, and we could have been badly treated. We were, yep. You know, the shareholders weren't diluted. It was like, you know, and I'd like to think we've kind of repaid that confidence back. You know, we've had the Phoenix investors had their AGM last week, and they had their investors come and have a look around 19. Yep. And I think they're very happy with us. But it was, you know, it could have, I'm very, very grateful, because we could have, you know, could have easily closed us down.
Yeah. Amazing. So they obviously, yeah, had confidence in the senior management team.
I think so. But also I think, you know, Phil was very influential. And, you know, for those of you who don't know, Phoenix were the first investors in Closer Still.
Yeah.
So, you know, they knew that actually once, you know, they knew the pandemic would last forever. That, you know, no one knew when shows would come back and in what format. But I think they knew that, you know, to put in a little bit of extra cash, it was worth seeing.
Sure.
You know, but, you know, doing the shows last September and then repeating the NEC show in April was quite, you know, it was quite difficult to do a 12-month show cycle in 6 months. But, you know, we did that and we managed to grow it as well. So,
coming on to talk about some of the acquisitions, because you mentioned Phoenix, you mentioned some of the companies you were speaking to during the pandemic, and I'm assuming some of those have now, you've just announced, the likes of Hennick Group, Lyrical, etc. To explain the strategy for those that aren't aware, explain the thinking behind acquiring a business rather than potentially, and I know you've done your own launches as well, rather than launching, and then some of the sort of challenges around that, because obviously you've chosen to, correct me if I'm wrong, obviously redevelop the 19 head office, integrate some of those teams that have come into 19 Group, rather than having them in the satellite offices, which other companies might do. Just explain, I guess, as I said, firstly, just around the sort of M&A piece and what you look out for when you're buying a business, and then secondly, how you integrate.
So obviously, there's only three ways you can grow a business, and it's like growing the core, launching, or acquiring. And acquiring is obviously the fastest way. It's the most expensive, but it's the fastest way to grow. And so we spend a lot of time with what I would call an acquisition target list. And so we don't have an M&A department. It's very much Peter goes in, not sit down, I go in, and then, you know, John, our CFO, comes in. I think we've got a really good recipe in that, because Peter's done it, you know, he's sold a business, he can really, every single deal, there's a wobble, you know, Sunday morning, someone wakes up and thinks, I don't want to do this. You can send Peter in and goes, I've walked in your shoes before.
Yeah, because so, it's an emotional experience, right, for the seller, I guess. They built it up, it's their baby, regardless of the money. You know, they want the staff to be looked after and so on, I guess.
Yeah. And so we can do that. And then, you know, John, Lacey and myself have worked, you know, done quite a lot of acquisitions. We can come in and go, look, it's going to be okay. And they're dealing with us three and not a kind of a, you know, an M&A department where, you know, I mean, I've worked in big companies and there are some extremely clever people. They all look about 10, you know, and they go into an owner operator. We've identified who we want to buy. We've got another three or four definitely that we'll do before we sell the business. And although Peter keeps saying it's six, I think it'll probably be three or four. And so we kind of identify it. And then, you know, getting the deals over the line, they're always tricky because, you know, private equity want it done properly. You know, you've got to dot the I's across the T. We'd much rather take the people with us. And you know, we've been lucky so far because they've all been geographically around here, so they can come here. So, but you know, yesterday we were talking to a target who are based up north. You know, we would clearly leave them up north. And so it's once we've got the deal done, then the hard work starts. And you know, people come from different cultures. It takes time. You know, I've been acquired, and it's quite, you know, sometimes it's quite hard because it's, you know, you feel like I'm not as good as the, you know, they think I'm not as good as the people that, you know, have acquired me. But it is, it's a people game. You've got to kind of, you've got to have a plan. You've got to reassure. And, you know, it's not, in my view, it's, you know, you say business as usual. It's never business as 100% as usual ever.
Yeah.
But in the, you know, in a lot of our instances, it has been business as usual because they've been good. They've been good businesses, but they've needed a little bit. Typically, they've needed a bit of investment.
Yeah.
And so we kind of, you know, each one's different, but, you know, some of them, so when we bought Western, for example, they didn't even have budgets. They just, you know, it was an owner-operator business.
Yeah.
Every year it gave the, you know, pile of invoices, and that's how they sorted out how much money they had. So we've got, you know, we've got the infrastructure, the finance, the kind of marketing operations, you know, additional salespeople. So we can just plug in and say, look, what do you need? And, you know, to touch wood, today it's gone really well. But, you know, it's always tricky, particularly if people are on earnouts. You kind of need to let them do their thing. You can't get in the way. But in the main, it's we've worked really, you know, I would say that in the moment we're just digesting Hennick and DFA here, although DFA didn't come with any people, and just putting all our manufacturing bits together. You know, it's people sensitive, it's a lot of different CRM systems, different ways of financing, and it's complicated. She's got to plan for it and just say to people, look, you know, I can't tell exactly when it will be doing the same way, but that's the direction of travel. But our plan is we'd like people to be here if possible, but clearly we want to be looking further than London, further than the UK, further than, you know, so that we'll, you know, at some point we'll have to have satellite offices.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because obviously to date, 19 Group is wholly and solely focused within the UK, if I'm not mistaken. And you mentioned Phoenix Group and their relationship with Closer Steel previously, which is now very much an international business. So do you see that happening anytime soon? And what sort of markets are you looking at? Is it continental Europe or US or
It's both. So, I mean, I don't know whether you're in Closer Steel, but at the time they were running overseas shows from London.
Yes. Yeah. I ran a show, it was in Germany from London. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, typically the big trade show organizers got obsessed with China, Asia, and the States. There are probably some opportunities closer to the UK, so mainland Europe. We have lots of people here who speak different languages, and so we will actively pursue that. I don't think we would, if we bought something that had something in China, that I don't think we're actively looking to go into China.
Yeah.
Although we are looking at something in Singapore at the moment, and so it's, I think, well, by the time, you know, in a couple of years we may look to flip the business. I think by that time we'd have things in our portfolio, or we'd be in the process of buying things or launching things that were outside the UK. Yeah.
So it's interesting because you're very open, and there's no reason why you wouldn't, about, you know, in a couple of years you're looking to potentially flip the business, because, you know, private equity and Phoenix specifically have got that track record. I was going to come and talk about building a company culture, and I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, obviously the staff know that, they know what the sort of goal is. You know, when I see a lot of posts around 19 on socials, it seems very obvious to me that you're trying to do everything you can to build a positive company culture. And even more so, obviously, bringing these extra people on board from the acquisitions that you've made. How do you sort of get everyone to buy into the fact that that's the journey that you're going to be going on? And it's not necessarily an owner-led business anymore, you know, and I guess people might have a stake in, you know, how do you go about that?
I mean, Peter talks about culture a lot, and for me, it's the only thing that matters, you know, and I've thought that for years, the only thing that matters. And, you know, but let's be clear, it's not for everybody here.
Yeah.
And I think you just got to be really honest and say, look, we run at 100 miles an hour, it's hard work, and, you know, but I think we pay people fairly, you know, we have uncapped commissions. You know, we're open and transparent, but still, we tell people, you know, that, you know, as much as we possibly can. There's some things you can't say, we're about to buy this business, or, you know, but I think just being transparent and just being really honest, and, you know, we've, you know, I've had lots of conversations in the last few years where people have said, look, I don't really like it here. It's too much, you know, yeah. It's too much. Yeah. It's kind of, you know, it isn't for everybody. I mean, I've, you know, I couldn't work in a massive corporate culture anymore where nothing happens. Yeah. And you, yeah. You know, trying to, you know, that's not for me. I'm much more useful. I'm much more suited to this kind of environment. But I think just to be honest and say, yes, it is, you know, we're trying to explain what private equity is in the best way we can. We don't have a share scheme quite the same as Closer Still, but we have a scheme. So, you know, there's with the people, you know, everybody who's here when we sell will make some money. Will it be changing? Not for everybody, but we're as honest as we can be. But, and I think as part of that, you've got to say, it's all right, so I don't like it.
Yeah. Thank you. I just want to move on to some of the other things that I know you're involved in that are close to your heart. So I know Women in Exhibitions, the membership organisation that I think in the UK only launched relatively recently.
During COVID, actually.
Yeah, during COVID. Why is that a passion? I mean, it might seem an obvious question, but why is that a passion for you?
You know what? I think I was talking to someone yesterday about it in the... They were quite rightly challenging me, saying, you know, well, you know, what about other forms of, you know, diversity? And absolutely, you know, right, you know, is life fair and equitable for everyone? No. And, you know, so I'm not saying it's just about women. Yep. The reality is, you know, look, it's got an awful lot better. You know, I would say I did really well in my career because I didn't have children. You know, because I was always around, and it was around me. There were when my career was in the ascendancy, I noticed that quite a lot of women sort of almost disappeared after the second child, and that companies weren't flexible about maternity leave, working from home, and all of that. And I saw a massive brain drain of talent. You know, where, you know, I mean, I don't think anyone's around now to sue me, but when I was at EMAP, I'd regularly see people come back from maternity leave, and then they'd leave. You know, they've been made redundant or a restructure.
Yeah.
And so it's much better. But I do think it's not about the kind of unfairness. It's more to do with helping women. They are very different to men, you know, and they're often the worst enemies. You know, they're not as often as, you know, isn't there a saying that if a man saw a job spec and he could do 6 out of 10 things, he'd apply for it. But a woman, if she could do 9 out of 10, she might not apply. So it's more about helping women and helping develop their talent and training, and, you know, how do you ask for a pay rise? How do you network? How do you go into a room and you don't know anybody? And it's not supposed to be a kind of, we think women are treated badly. It's supposed to be about to helping them. And I mean, you know, I don't have a huge amount of time to help them, but is it sad that 30 years later we still need something? I don't think so. I think it's a group to network, help, train, learn, rather than, you know, be a kind of feminist and say it's all unfair.
It's not exclusive either. I've seen obviously men join some of the networking groups. So I don't think it's not an exclusive, you know, female orientated organisation from that perspective. You very much want everyone included in the conversation.
It's a community, and actually, and again, you know, and I recognise that, you know, you know, are there other forms of diversity that need paying attention to? Yeah. But it's, you know, this is the one that I can identify with. And have I seen sexism in the exhibition industry? Yeah. But has it got better? Absolutely. You know.
Let me ask you a question, because I've spoken about this a few times on this show. So, yes, things would have got better from a gender perspective, you know, over the last 30 years. But in terms of women on the boards and in senior positions like yourself, you know, someone once said to me, typically people sort of go through that route if they start off in sales rather than marketing, and you still see marketing departments probably more, I don't know, 60, 70% female. How can you, you know, outside of the sales route, how can sort of a woman, a female in an exhibition organization sort of make their way towards the top? So we might have representation generally, but do you still think that's a challenge, sort of getting to this more senior positions?
I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know. Lisa Hannant is just the new CEO of Clarion. I'm not sure. I mean, she probably correct me. I'm not sure that she came up the sales route.
Yeah.
I think it's possible. And I think it's encouraging it and saying, look, you know, our leadership team is 50-50 and not all the females came up the sales route. So I think it's possible, and it's also, you know, changing the perception, saying you don't, you know, you can go down that route. You just need to kind of believe in yourself and you know, network like hell, train yourself up, you know, put yourself forward. And yeah. So I think it is, you know, it's much better. You know, it's much better than it used to be.
So just we're getting towards the end. In terms of other sort of challenges for the industry generally, obviously there's lots of talk about sustainability. We've spoken about one element of diversity inclusion. What do you think are the main challenges that the industry overall are facing, and how do you think we can overcome those?
I think relevant. I mean, I think, you know, look, the sustainability piece is really important.
Yeah.
But I kind of get slightly irritated when we just get down to carpets and stuff, and you know, it's much more about carbon footprint, and you know, yeah. You know, we're sort of lucky in some ways in that we're not most of our visitors to shows are coming from about 90 minutes radius, so they're not, it's not a huge carbon footprint. So I think there's that challenge. There's the challenge of relevance data, but I'm really optimistic. I mean, I'm not quite as tiggerish as Peter, but I really believe in the trade show concept.
Yep.
You know, and I'm so old, Dan, that, you know, when I ran a joint venture called Fresh RM, it was Montgomery's and Reed. And I remember going to a meeting at Reed and a guy coming in, and we called it Black Tuesday. So this guy came in, this guest speaker, and he said the internet was going to be completely destroyed, trade shows. And, you know, it was not a great day. Oh, my God, what are we going to do? Well, of course, it never, you know, new things coming in, each other. So I think it's just, I think I'm passionate about data, relevant data, and making sure your event is refreshed. And of course, if you're rebooking at high rates, your event is in danger of looking the same. You know, you have to work hard to mix it up and change it and make sure you're working on the product and that it's relevant and you've got great content. But I mean, maybe I'm naive. You know, Putin drops a bomb. Well, you know, that's probably the biggest, you know, it's not particularly great reading out there in the press, The economy. But I mean, even the recession, you know, the fact is that Close the Still was formed in a recession. And, you know, our CEO, Peter Jones, built a business in a recession. Yeah. So again, being so old, I've lived through three recessions. And actually one in a private company, Montgomery's, and the next one within a public company, EMAP. And I do think it is mindset. I do think what tends to happen is in the big company, it's a bit like, oh, shit, you know, recession's coming. Let's take some cost out. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You just decline because you've taken the cost out. You've not left the people in. So I think I'm pretty optimistic about the future.
Yeah. Good. What advice would you give to your 18-year-old self?
I'm just laughing at myself. When I was 18, I came from Wigan going to, I failed my A-levels. That's why I went to Bristol Poly at the time. So my dad said, doing them again, you might fail them. And so just don't get too hung up about the small things in life, because and I worry, I've got a 12-year-old daughter, nearly 13. And I do worry about, you know, how anxious kids get about the smallest thing, you know. And I keep saying to her, look, I think you've got an Izzy as well, haven't you? Will you be worried about this in 6 weeks' time? No, well, then don't worry about it, you know. Yeah. So I think it's just my advice to my 18-year-old self would be go for it. Take every opportunity you can. Absolutely go for it. And if it, you know, it's nothing to ever... No, you know, just take a punt, go for it, go with your gut, and don't worry too much about the small things.
Yeah, good advice. And if you're unfortunately washed up on a desert island after an exhibition, trade show, bash on a boat, who would you like to be with you, and why? A couple of people.
What, for trade show people? God, yeah. I'm trying to get away from them. you know what? I mean, I think I've been so lucky.
Yeah.
I was interviewed originally by Brian Montgomery. You know, it was great. I mean, you never met anyone from Wigan, you know. And so probably someone like a real odd mix, like, you know, yeah. Montgomery, probably Simon Kimball, just because he'd make me laugh. And then my group of girls, I've got a real, you know, Lisa and Suzanne King. There's too many people that I like, you know. Yeah. There's no one that I wouldn't particularly want to be washed up with.
What about what about a historical figure? Who would inspire you to spend some time on a deserted island?
Probably, it's a really trite one, isn't it? But the best book I've ever read is like Nelson Mandela.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so, and, you know, was obsessed with him for a while, read his biography, went to South Africa. But, or the Queen, I love the Queen. She reminds me of
Perfect. Listen, Alison, thank you so much for your time.